Thank you, everyone. You may be seated.
Good morning.
Come on, we can do better than that. Good morning.
Good, that's better. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is September 12, 2024. We have three cases on our calendar today. First, before we begin, I want to thank everyone for coming today. I especially want to thank the New Ulm Court Administrator's Office and their staff for accommodating us today. Thank you so much in this beautiful courthouse. I want to welcome some local members of the community for coming today. Thank you very much. And I think we're ready to go. Do we have counsel here for our first case?
We do.
We do. Why don't you have a seat, counsel? All right, thank you. I am going to call the first case. It's A240382, Osmundson versus Commissioner of Public Safety. Counsel, you're familiar with our proceedings. We have 15 minutes for each party. The appellant has an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal at your option. I ask you to state your name and identify your client before you begin speaking. And these matters are being recorded. That is the only recording that is permitted. Counsel for appellant. Are both of you counsel at the table?
No, he's my client. He should probably sit in the back.
Yes, we only allow counsel at table. Thank you very much, sir. One moment. Do we clock? I can't see the clock. Will it be on the screen or not really? Or it won't be visible to me? Okay. All right. I'm going to use my stopwatch on the phone so I can monitor the clock as well. Just so you can see it. All right. And counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready, we're ready for you.
I take the podium, is okay.
Yes.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel, Attorney Jacob Burkholz here for appellant, Stacey Osmundson. Today's matter before the court really is fairly straightforward. We're asking, appellant is requesting this court to reimburse the district court's decision. The district court's decision came upon this court from a 171.19 challenge after a misdemeanor plea of guilty by Mr. Osmundson to leaving the scene of an accident that was vacated by agreement for motion. District court granted that on agreement of the prosecutor and district court counsel.
Yes. Yes. Go ahead, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court and opposing counsel, Attorney Jacob Burkholz for appellant, Stacey Osmundson. In this case, appellant is changed decision, asking for a reversal of that decision. The decision came upon the court on a 171.19 challenge. That challenge came upon that a request of Mr. Osmundson to challenge the Department of Vehicle Services, Commissioner of Public Safety, their decision to refuse to honor the district court's vacation of a guilty plea to leaving the scene of an accident. So there are facts and procedure to get here, I think, are fairly straightforward. The underlying motion, Mr. Osmundson pled guilty on his own. Really, I guess, didn't understand what consequences there would be. Hired counsel came before the court, asked for that to be vacated. That was done by agreement of the prosecutor and the defense.
I think we're talking about records that are held by the Commissioner of Public Safety, which, as you've conceded in your materials that were submitted to us, are distinct from the records that are held by the judicial branch. So, my question to you, counsel, is when you look at Bergman, excuse me, and 171.166, isn't the remedy that you're seeking, which is to correct the records that are held by the commissioner, isn't that something that has to go to the commissioner within 30 days of the commissioner's decision under subdivision 3 of the statute, as opposed to via judicial relief in an implied consent proceeding?
It's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that in terms of, I think it highlights one of the procedural challenges to the commissioner of saying, well, we didn't notice, we weren't participating, we standing in that case. And so what was the proper decision and how did we seek relief? No, clear form, clear guidance, or appellate materials, or case law, district court, or appellate, that. So I can't fully answer that. But do I agree that it has created a challenge for the commissioner? Because the procedure that maybe is challenging, it comes from the decision from the district court, but then it's emailed after perhaps a month after the district court's order, my office had requested clarity that the record had and DBS through DBS service email indicated that they were not going to record administratively. That wasn't initially through the attorney general's office, so not a formal legal proceeding. But I think we get to the same. This court provides some guidance for future filings and for future people. I certainly think that would be appropriate. How that should come before this court, but the issue substantively would remain the same, and that would have that request been filed and served through your records, maintain a proper record filing, with their position same, meaning that DBS's records still maintain a copy of an initial plea of guilty for legal routine, and they have that system. Just like any expungement of death is always true, I learned the hard way in the state versus MDT, 2013 in the Supreme Court, that of course that just matter the separation of powers and where we left. And so, but I think the issue becomes it's still a vacated, no conviction. And I do think that the commissioner takes an interesting position that I think the second part of the Code of Federal Regulation definitely somehow really isn't a conviction, that some lesser standard should be applied, meaning if we have a record where someone puts guilty something, that's good enough, and therefore we can take action. I'm not going to dispute the construction. And I feel kind of solid that that's existing and it's in the record. Has it? Now,
so, counsel, one of the other questions that I have relates to this document that you submitted to the district court from the National Traffic Law Center about masking, this quick reference guide. This was a document that you submitted to the district court, correct? Okay. One of the questions that the commissioner raised is, regardless of whether there is a conviction, it's the underlying conduct that is the triggering incident to revoke the commercial driver's license. And when I look at the last entry on the quick reference guide, it talks about leaving the scene of a collision. And in the example that's provided on the document, it indicates there's no in the situation where there's no action by the prosecutor, and the only action by the court is a direction that a driver make a charitable donation to Mothers Against Drunk Driving. In lieu of a conviction, that would still amount to masking, and that would also trigger the revocation of a CDL. So that's a long way of me asking you, why is it even relevant whether there's a conviction?
Well, there's a lack of materials on what it means. What prosecutors, attorneys, really, I view anti-masking as kind of, what is it? How is it applied, if applied at all? It usually comes from the prosecutor saying, I won't do that because I'm not supposed to.
Or the court, right?
Right. Or the court. Absolutely. The court should say we shouldn't do it.
So why isn't it what you're asking for here? Why doesn't it constitute masking?
That's a good question. Does it or doesn't it? I think when, as I read masking materials, I did buy when I come into those debates, usually underlying with prosecutors when we're trying to negotiate a case that triggers a potential for masking, that my view is if there is substantive, either legal challenge, evidentiary concerns, witness availability, strength of the state's case, that those are non-masking reasons, meaning a prosecutor kind of the basis to say, you know what, maybe I can't prove this case. Maybe it is just good, I think, and et cetera, and not be engaged.
So I also looked at the video the officer's body worn camera, which has your client eventually admitting to the officer that he hit the car and left the scene of the accident. So I don't consider this case as one of those cases where there are evidentiary concerns or the state would not have been able to prove its case. So what category would this case fall into? Where it wouldn't be masking?
I think at the time that statute existed, I think it requires there's a notice requirement.
That there was a notice that of what?
In order to leave the scene of an accident, there, I think one of the subsequent reports that got removed from the statute post the time of the incident. So the question is, when are you liable for leaving the scene of an accident?
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't, like the quick guide, doesn't go into the detail of what that really means. And it, actually, I won on a dismissal request in Nicola County on the leaving the scene, where the question wasn't whether the party left, it's whether or not there was notice or that police obtained notice within time frame of statute. And so in that particular case...
Just help me out here. Notice of what?
That there was damage, that the incident was reported. So in fact, if you admit to having an accident and notify either the person that had it or law enforcement, yeah, it's been modified last year. We omit one of them. Then the question becomes, well, was there proper notice? And so if proper notice, so it used to be if you hit you engaged, crashed your car, hit a public fixture along the roadway in 10 days. I don't know if that still exists in the statute, but it was there where you had a time to report property damage. Now, if there's a physical injury or death, but immediately you have to stay on the scene. And then that doesn't apply either. It's not a fixture case. And so what amount of time is necessary? So if an officer, so in the other case that's not challenged, was that the officer actually went to the person's house. They saw the person hit the light, didn't see it, but it was reported, came and went to the person's house right away. But it wasn't immediate. Came to the house and obtained the information from the driver. Did you hit it? Did I see your car? It's damaged. Yep. Take care of it. No problem. And in that case, law enforcement had created the report and submitted it to DBS as required through their reporting of the vehicle. So all the elements of the statute have been met.
But there was no argument before the district court about notice in this case, was there?
No, because it never was challenged.
Mm-hmm.
It never became into a contested proceeding. No, in the front of the big fight,
mm-hmm.
like a public witness, I'm sure. The idea that I believe when I talked about that there was a factual injury. No, just because he hit a parked car on the home and the officer came to the scene and talked to him, I'm not sure that automatically essentially creates zero defense. If we even see it, there's no possible way. And I think that's
what about the fact that he denied it? That he denied hitting the car and leaving the scene.
Yes, we did. I mean, humanity is.
You know, applying common sense, generally, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Burkles, if you hit a parked car and there's no one there, you kind of put a note on it saying, hey, I hit a park. It was me. Here's, call my insurance, put the number on. And, you know, that didn't happen. Would that be a fair statement?
True, but it was right by his house.
Again, it was down the street, yes. Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get deep into the facts. But he's so close, I think we're in a birth in the city. They're right there. Anticipated. You know the person. You let them know in the morning. Tell me sorry. It's insurance. Right? And we could challenge that in the jury. I think win. But yeah, I'm sorry. It's right there. My car's here. My house is here. I'm here. We're here. You know me. I know you.
I have an evidentiary question for you, counsel. The body-worn camera was submitted by you before the district court, but it was not received as a piece of evidence. My understanding from reading the record, just to clarify, was that it was submitted as part of an offer of proof. And what is the evidentiary value for us on appeal? It's part of our record, but what role does it play as part of our record, in your view?
I anticipated this conversation at the time, and I said, well, to the district court judge, I didn't think it was relevant or wanted to hear, which is why I would consider is I thought there was some factual. I wanted to make sure that Mr. Brunton, the court, district court, knew that when I looked at the case and said, there's some pieces of evidence here that I think create a plausible reason that it's not asking. Now, we can, of course, prosecutor and defense attorney would disagree as the value and interpretation of evidence at the time. Say, yes, I need this other information. This is admission bad, it's good for my case, etc. But the fact that I was not afraid and said, look, there are reasons, there is information potentially there that I could go back and challenge the case in front of Mr. Court. Mr. Front's not wrong that we reached this resolution. And Mr. Front provided other reasons. It's not complaining, there's no prosecution, there's no breach of public safety, etc. But my view was that it went to the heart of validity and strength of the state's case.
And you would have no objection to us considering that document on appeal or that piece of evidence on appeal, given that you submitted it to the district court?
I do have that. I the court can consider it.
Great. Thank you.
I will summarize my argument, but what maybe I didn't get to is that because there's no dispute the district court vacated the guilty plea, does not meet the statutory
definition of the law. Let's pursue that in the time you have left. Why doesn't it meet the other parts of the definition of conviction under the CFR, which include a determination that a person has violated or failed to comply with the law, or a plea of guilty? I mean, here we had a plea of guilty, and it doesn't say an unwithdrawn plea of guilty. It says a plea of guilty.
Good question, Ryan. For the statutory interpretation, a lot of time in briefs, but the unvacated piece would have to be read synonymously. Essentially, an unvacated conviction would be equivalent to vacated plea of guilty. So, in other words, vacated plea of guilty.
Thank you. Any other questions? You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you, counsel. You need to start the recording. Okay. It's okay, counsel, whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Matthew McGuire, Assistant Attorney General, here on behalf of the respondent, Commissioner of Public Safety. I'm here today to ask the court to affirm the district court's decision. This case is about what DVS is supposed to do when a person pleads guilty to an offense that disqualifies their CDL privileges and then modifies that plea to avoid the CDL consequences. Here, appellant left the scene of an accident, pleaded guilty to leaving the scene of an accident, then realized that his conviction meant his commercial driving privileges would be withdrawn. He then hired counsel and vacated his plea, And in his motion to vacate, appellant stated that he was unaware of the consequences for his CDL and wanted to change his plea. He subsequently pleaded guilty to a public nuisance offense, a non-driving related infraction that will not appear on his driving record. At the plea hearing, appellant admitted to colliding with another vehicle and leaving his vehicle in the roadway. He also admitted that the main goal of the new plea agreement was to avoid the collateral consequences of a CDL suspension.
Counsel, the plea transcript is not part of our record. So what do we do about that?
I believe the district court took judicial notice of it, and it is a public record filed within the leaving the scene of the accident criminal file.
And so it's your belief that we should go to the criminal file and pull that transcript?
It is available publicly.
Okay.
One other evidentiary matter I would just like to correct. I was actually the one that submitted the quick reference guide from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. When appellant applied for and received a CDL, he knew all of his driving conduct would be subject to higher scrutiny. And this is because commercial vehicles are larger and more deadly when operated dangerously. When respondent received record of appellant's conviction for leaving the scene of an accident, it was required under state and federal law to disqualify appellant from operating a commercial motor vehicle. That determination was not arbitrary or capricious.
Can I just ask hypothetically, so say someone is convicted in district court of driving while impaired, a DWI, and they take an appeal because there was no reasonable articulable suspicion for the stop of the automobile. And the appellate court agrees and says there was no reasonable articulable suspicion for the stop of the automobile. And so the conviction is reversed and remanded. What effect does that have on the records that are held by the commissioner? Does the commissioner still get to revoke a driver's license even though a conviction has been revoked?
If I'm understanding your conviction, meaning the conviction was completely overturned on appeal, I think in that circumstance, DVS would not maintain that record because there was something procedural and substantive wrong with the underlying conviction.
And why is that any different than withdrawing a plea because the plea was unintelligent?
Well, I think if this court looks to how the federal government looks at vacated convictions in other contexts, in particular the immigration context, immigration agencies are still allowed to take action in those circumstances if there's a vacated plea, so long as there's evidence that the sole purpose for vacating the plea is to avoid the collateral consequences to immigration. There's not a lot of clear appellate or case law in general about what somebody is supposed to do in a circumstance where there is a procedural and substantive issue. But in that instance, if an individual were to have their conviction vacated on appeal and DVS were for some reason to maintain that record of conviction, they would be entitled to and the subsequent disqualification of their CDL privileges. I believe in that circumstance, the individual would have the right to file a 1719 petition and have a court review the decision.
But why wouldn't the language in the CFR, a determination that a person has violated or failed to comply with the law in the court of original jurisdiction apply? I mean, you're basically making that argument here, as I understand it, that even though this conviction was vacated, for executive branch purposes, Commissioner of Public Safety purposes, that's unimportant because there still was a guilty plea and a termination of a violation of the law. How is this situation, you know, distinguishable from the hypothetical we were discussing?
I think in this circumstance, there's two things that happen. There's a subsequent conviction for an offense where the facts pleaded to are the exact same as the original disqualifying offense. And I also think that in that instance, the judicial it might be true that the judicial determination that someone had failed to comply with the law wouldn't still hold. But I think for this case, what we can look at is pretty clear evidence in the record that this wasn't an issue of procedure or substance. This was someone trying to change their plea in order to avoid a collateral consequence. I believe that counsel testified as such in the criminal case. Prosecutor testified at the 1719 hearing that this wasn't an issue where he was concerned about being able to meet his burden. He basically saw a case where there was no demand for restitution and let appellant plead guilty to an offense of roughly the same level. And that is where masking concerns come in, is because it's in a deliberate attempt to hide disqualifying conduct. I think there would be due process concerns if DBS were to maintain that record after the, if there was some procedural substantive issue with an underlying conviction, but I don't believe that that concern is present in this case.
Counsel, your esteemed colleague has suggested that there's a real lack of guidance in this space. Do you share that concern? And if so, are you asking us for a precedential opinion to provide some guidance?
My friend on the other side is correct. There is a lack of case law in Minnesota on masking issues. This court could look to analogous cases, both in the federal immigration context, but also within Minnesota's context with regards to expunging records. However, specifically with masking, there's no case law in Minnesota. There's no case law in neighboring states. I was able to find one irrelevant case in Illinois on it. I would ask this court to publish a precedential decision.
It says what?
Yeah, that's a, yeah.
What would it say? What would you like? What would the syllabus point be? What does the Attorney General want the presidential opinion in a nutshell to say?
That the commissioner does not act arbitrarily or capriciously when disqualifying a CDL holder's privileges when there's clear and convincing evidence or some other evidentiary standard that masking has occurred and a district court has agreed with that. And both Minnesota law and federal law forbid masking, and it's a practice by which a defendant enters a guilty plea to an alternative offense other than the one originally charged to avoid a collateral consequence. In this case, appellant vacated the original conviction and subsequently pled to a public nuisance offense in order to mask the original conviction and avoid CDL disqualification. Prosecutor testified that he was aware of appellant's CDL, the impact of the hit and run conviction on those privileges, and that appellant's counsel proposed a plea agreement that would allow petitioner to plead guilty to an offense that would not impact his driving record. It is clear that appellant was initially unaware of the consequences of the hit and run conviction and that his sole goal in vacating that conviction was to avoid those consequences. Appellant and the prosecutor then created a plea agreement that would allow him to plead to a non-driving offense to keep the incident off his record. This is the exact conduct that masking that is prohibited by Minnesota and federal law.
Do we even need to reach the issue of masking? And I ask that because of Bergman, because Bergman limits the court's ability to direct the commissioner to alter its records. And it appears to me that under 171-166 subdivision 3, there is a remedy available to an aggrieved party to seek relief directly from the commissioner from a disqualification if they do so within 30 days. So do we have to even get to the issue of masking?
I think masking is inextricably linked. It's intertwined in this case in sort of the factual basis for the convictions and how the convictions are recorded. Masking is a big concern of the commissioners as it is related directly to federal highway money, tens of millions of dollars that Minnesota receives. And while the Bergman case is certainly persuasive as to how the judicial branch may be able to reach executive branch records, whether it's not through the inherent authority of the court or through some other matter that the legislator might have defined, ultimately, the conviction in Bergman was not vacated. It was a request for an expungement of a conviction, not a vacated conviction.
Why does that matter? I mean, the principle, which is more than persuasive, it's binding because this is from the Supreme Court, it says that the judicial branch has no authority given separation of powers to interfere with the records that are held by the commissioner, which is a member of the executive branch.
And
that's the relief they were seeking in the implied consent proceeding.
It's maybe not persuasive isn't the right word, but perhaps distinguishable on that small factual point, difference between a vacation and expungement. In this case, the federal definition of conviction, I believe, still carries the day. That second part of the federal CFR, which talks about a determination by a judicial court that somebody has failed to comply with the law, is written so broadly as to encompass any remedy that courts might grant in lieu of traditional criminal penalties imposed, such as a fine or other sentences. And the district court properly concluded, although it requested DBS to modify its records to reflect appellant's modified plea to public nuisance, DBS was not required to modify those records, and appellant's CDL should remain disqualified. The court's reasoning was twofold. The district court was unable to expunge the conviction under its inherent authority, and the appellant's conviction still qualified as a conviction under the federal statute.
Can I ask you about the CFR and the definition of conviction as including plea of guilty after the court? What is your position as to whether there is still a conviction if that plea is later withdrawn?
I think the way that the federal statute is written, a plea of guilty that is still later withdrawn would still qualify as a conviction for the purposes of a CDL. In this context, I'd like to remind the court that CDL holders are a very select group of drivers and a very select class of people who this law might affect that are subject to a higher scrutiny because of the potential danger that they might impose on public safety. So in that context, I think that a court or executive agency reviewing a record could still make a determination that somebody should be disqualified based on the conduct, assuming that there were no procedural or substantive issues with the underlying case. I'd like to use the remainder of my time to give the court a helpful citation for a federal case with regards to the immigration analogy. Pickering v. Gonzalez, 465 F3D 263 at 266. It's a Sixth Circuit court in 2006. There, the Sixth Circuit held that when a court vacates an alien's convictions for reasons solely related to rehabilitation or to avoid adverse immigration hardships, rather than on the basis of a procedural or substantive defect in the underlying criminal proceedings, the conviction is not eliminated for immigration purposes. In other words, solely because somebody vacates a conviction for the purposes of avoiding a collateral consequence, the executive agency can still take action based on that conviction. I will end my time by asking the court to affirm the district court's decision and sustain the disqualification. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Mr. Burkholz, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it, sir. One moment.
Thank you, may it please the court. There are so many good things to talk about. Let's talk about the Code of Federal Regulations, Your Honor, for this point. When you're looking at it, unvacated appears twice, as it actually is the modifier for the remainder of the provisions. And it is not limited to when it says or. It says unvacated adjudication of guilt or determination. Then reading further, it says unvacated again, forfeiture of bail. It continues. So that unvacated would be either an unvacated plea of guilty. So that modifier appears to be consistent in the entire paragraph, coming up at least twice. The other piece of that, where it says a plea of guilty accepted by the court. Well, if it's withdrawn, I believe it's no longer accepted by the court. So under either definition, either it's vacated, it doesn't exist. The following on that, and federal law I've cited, says a vacated conviction is a nullity.
I'm not quite sure that that necessarily follows, because as you know, counsel, a guilty plea is acquired by someone being placed under oath and asked questions, specific factual questions about the events that would make them guilty. And the fact that the plea has been withdrawn doesn't necessarily negate the fact that someone has sworn under oath that certain things have happened, or that certain things are true. So explain to me the authority that the withdrawal of a guilty plea somehow wipes out someone's admissions under oath in open court.
I agree. It's similar to seeking an enhancer in a prior plea when the plea is invalid. So to the elements of what it makes to have an effective plea, knowing, voluntary, intelligent, and it has to meet all the elements. Of course, we have numerous reversals where you don't plead to all the elements, the charge is reversed. There's no conviction.
There's a legal consequence to that.
Correct.
But not necessarily a factual one.
Well, if you don't admit the factual basis, then there isn't one in the record to admit. And I would submit, when I looked, I think it's a bit sloppy. I always hate to go on the records for Faribault County. I don't think even Mr. Osmondson admitted to what you're saying. I don't think there's any factual record. I think it just was, do you plead guilty? You want to pay a fine? Yep, I accept your guilty plea. Now, can I come here as an officer of the court and say that with affirmations? But my recollection, talking to my client and reviewing on transcript, we don't have it. But if the court's concerned, I suggest a reverse and remand. If there's some sort of published basis, it would be on more of the procedure. And if it's proper procedure to challenge it from a slightly different context, to proceed under 171-166 subdivision 2 versus a 171-19 to clear records, we may be in the same place. But to your honest point, I think you keep going back to the foundation. And the foundation being, are there facts in the records for this reviewing court to verify that actual admissions to every element of leaving the scene has been met? If it's true, and we reverse and remand, I think that would happen in runaround with a 171-166 petition, again, from a procedural standpoint, or if any future case would be in the same boat, we'd go back to the foundations. Now, it also goes back to the point of, well, should I have phrased my motion differently? All defense attorneys will from now on. And I would certainly have said that the plea was manifest injustice and involuntarily inadequately entered. And I think both of those are the same. I also don't believe that being dishonest is helpful. Of course, he doesn't want a collateral consequence. But the fact that there is a basis to do so. Now, the challenge we have is Mr. Front, the prosecutor, agreed. We didn't get into the underlying record and the court didn't challenge. So if this court wants to cast caution and say we have to verify the pleas, we have to make sure the elements are met, and we have to verify that the information before we start vacating pleas, so be it. And district court should be on notice from this court that we need to take a closer look at whether or not there are factual and other reasons to avoid anti-mask.
I had two questions, Mr. Burkholz. So both the leaving and the scene of the accident and the public nuisance, are those both misdemeanors? Or are they?
Yeah. Yes.
They're both misdemeanors. And then does the record indicate what the first instance was? Because apparently this was your client's.
Old DUI.
Thank you.
So I think the foundations are faulty, but they don't come in clear in the record.
Can I ask one question? When the client agreed to enter a guilty plea for the public nuisance charge, is it correct that he admitted driving a vehicle, colliding with another vehicle, and leaving the scene without doing any particular decision? That's what respondent agreed to.
I don't believe that's the correct verbiage. My understanding is that some of that is correct. But I think he hit a car, but not that he left the scene. that there was a car in the roadway and that the car was unsafe or something, and that the public nuisance was the fact that a car was there. But I don't think the elements were, I don't want to misquote the record, but I don't believe that's a completely accurate statement.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much, counsel. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within 90 days. Thank you so much.